Hi, I'm Nick Gillespie, and this is The Reason Podcast. Please subscribe to us at iTunes and rate and review us while you're there. Today, we are talking with Reason Features article, Peter Suderman. Peter, thanks for talking to us.
Thanks for having me.
And we're talking about the Republican healthcare bill, which, you know, got through. What is in the Republican healthcare bill, and is it a good thing or a bad thing?
So the bill that passed in the House today is the American Healthcare Act, and it's not a great bill. And the biggest reason why it's not a great bill is that it kind of locks into place Obamacare's essential tax and subsidy and regulations scheme, but does it in a way that I think is arguably even worse than Obamacare. And I say that as someone who has been a critic of Obamacare since its passage.
So how is it? I mean, this is part of the problem with Obamacare, which I guess in the end, I'm forgetting his name, the Supreme Court Justice John Roberts, was right that, you know, this is it's a tax, it's a fine, it's a fee or something, but it's really not about healthcare ultimately. So what is it? How is the Republican plan to kind of tax certain people and subsidize payments? It's worse than Obamacare. How?
So the way Obamacare works is that for the individual market, which is where Obamacare is concentrated in addition to the Medicaid expansion, for the individual market, there's a system of subsidies, and those subsidies go to people based on their income. So you get subsidies to buy health insurance if you make up to 400% of the poverty line, which is somewhere around $90,000 or so for a family of four. And the subsidies get larger as you make less money. And there's an additional layer of subsidies that are kind of incidentally subject to some legal wrangling right now for people below 250% of the poverty line. And then in addition to that, Obamacare has an individual mandate that requires everyone to carry coverage or pay a fine to the IRS. And it also has a list of what are called essential health benefits, which are the stuff that insurers have to include
in every plan.
Right. In every plan. And so what
and those are all if we can just, let's stipulate for a second. Like, yeah, those are all terrible things. The individual mandate, I mean, you know, is terrible because it forces people to engage in activity at the behest of the government, economic activity. We wrote a lot and talked a lot about that. It mandates one size fits. I mean, it's not one size fits all, but it sets a floor that is much higher than it would be otherwise. To say
it heavily regulates insurance through the essential health benefits provisions, and then through some of the other requirements in terms of the ways that it deals with the metal tiers of plans, gold, silver, and bronze, each of which has to cover a certain amount of your expected health expenses and things like that. And in addition to all of these sort of libertarian reasons why you might not like the individual mandate is also a policy mechanism that doesn't work very well in a lot of ways. It actually, the goal of it is to bring people into the insurance market to make sure that there's enough people paying into the pool that everybody's premiums stay low. And the individual mandate has not done that very well. And that's one of the reasons why premiums have continued to rise, why insurers are pulling out of the market in across the country, and why a bunch of states and counties are really only going to be served by one insurer in this coming year. And so Obamacare has struggled with all of these things. And what the American Healthcare Act does is it basically makes them worse. It doesn't have an individual mandate, but what it does have is a penalty assessed by insurers rather than the government if you go without coverage. And so for the first year that you return to the market, you pay an additional 30% surcharge. So the government is still mandating a penalty here. It's just a different penalty. But that penalty is even less effective than the individual mandate, which, as I said, is already sort of a policy that doesn't work on its own terms. And what it does is it actually gives people an incentive who have dropped out of the market and are sick, or who have dropped out of the market and are healthy, to stay out of the marketplace meaning that it is likely to exacerbate the meltdown of the individual insurance markets across the country. Now, it does do some other stuff thanks to the House Freedom Caucus. It allows states to apply for a federal waiver that would get states out of the essential health benefits rules and community rating, which is the kind of key provision. And when we talk about the Obamacare's pre-existing conditions regulations, it's what we're really talking about is community rating and guaranteed issue. And this would allow states to get out of parts of community rating. However, it's not really clear that any states would take them up on this, would pursue a waiver. States that did want to would have to go get permission from the federal government. So even if you think this is a good thing to allow people out of to allow states to get out of community rating, it's not exactly their choice. Probably they would be able to obtain those waivers under the Trump administration, but who knows in the future if there's a Democratic president. And the waivers only can last up to a decade, so they'd have to be renewed. It's this complicated bureaucratic process.
How does the new bill treat pre-existing conditions and must issue insurance? Because that, you know, I think for a lot of people, including libertarians and market friendly people, that question of what do you do with somebody who's just by dint of birth or genetics or bad luck is just fucked, and they're going to have really expensive health care that puts them out of the market. You know, that was one of the things where people could be like, okay, this is a place, you know, for government to step in and help smooth over things. How does the American Health Care Act deal with that?
So I'll answer your question, but first I want to roll back the tape just a little bit to set some context here so that people understand. Before Obamacare, it was not the case that insurance companies everywhere, that most people were sort of at high risk for being denied coverage due to pre-existing conditions, because that's not how it works with employer coverage. Employer coverage, you get a group rate, and most people get their coverage through their work. Now, some people don't, and those are the people who are sort of more at risk.
But it's important
to people could be denied in the individual market.
Right. What were we talking about in terms of, because this is also one of the things, if we're in a country of 330 million people or something, what were the number of people who were actually in that kind of heartbreak situation of, I have a pre-existing condition, I do not have a job, but I don't qualify for Medicare or Medicaid. You know, what was the number or what was the universe of
those
people?
There's a couple of ways to look at this. One is that the individual market, which is where Obamacare and the American Health Care Act are really focused, they're primarily about reorganizing the individual market rather than the whole healthcare system, although they do sort of have some potential effects that sort of spread into the employer market. But really, they're focused on the individual market. In most states that had reasonably healthy and functional individual insurance marketplaces, it was about 5 or 6% of the marketplace. And so that's what the individual market was. Now, if you want to talk about people with really serious pre-existing conditions cases who were in the individual market or who couldn't get insurance through their jobs or some other way, one way to look at that number is to look at who signed up for the high-risk pool system that was put in place after Obamacare was passed in 2010, but before its major provisions went into effect in 2014. There was this program called the PCIP, which is the Pre-Existing Conditions Insurance Program or something like that. Basically, it was a high-risk pool a temporary high-risk pool system funded by the federal government and then run through the states. The program was only ended up having about 115,000 people sign up for it. And those are the people who you presume are sort of the really hard cases, the people who just had to have some kind of insurance. And so it's maybe not the only way to count those folks,
right,
but it's not a bad way.
It's useful
to see that in that period, right before Obamacare came online, there were only 115,000 people who were like, I've got to have this insurance. I've got to go to this fallback program for the hardest cases.
One of the reasons I bring that up is because earlier this week, Jimmy Kimmel, the late night host, talked about his son who was born with a child with a heart defect, and he somehow turned that into, and this is why we need Obamacare. And, you know, the leveraging on a certain level, and this happens all the time in policy, where you leverage completely atypical examples into the basis for a vast and, you know, unstoppable new policy that is really going to kind of eat the world. And it's frustrating no end. And I know that part of your ire at what the legislation that passes, that the Republicans here, you know, they had an opportunity to do something different or to fix something, and they chose not to.
Yeah, I think the Republican health care bill, like I said, I'm no fan of Obamacare, and I think it is actually worse than Obamacare, and that Republicans would have been better off taking more time to try and figure out what it is they really think about healthcare, and what it is they really want to do to try to identify some of the real problems with the way that health policy is handled in the country, in particular things like Medicare's, like sort of the dominance of Medicare. One single payer, you know, fully socialized program, healthcare program in the country, right? It's a totally federal program that covers healthcare for all seniors. It is, but Republicans love single payer. And in fact, Republicans love Medicare. And in fact, Trump promised not to cut Medicare. And one of the biggest criticisms that Republicans made of Obamacare was that Obamacare was partially paid for through cuts to Medicare. And so that's not something that Republicans are really willing to do. And then the other big issue with the U.S. healthcare system is this tax carve out that has been in place since about World War II for coverage that you get through your employer. And what that has done is created a huge sort of inequity in the system where folks, where the majority of folks who get coverage through their workplace are treated one way and have, in general, pretty robust benefits and are totally shielded from all the costs. Because most of those folks don't not only get tax advantaged coverage, they also don't pay the bulk of their premium themselves. And so they're paying whatever, $100 a month or a few hundred dollars a month or $0 a month in some cases. And they don't really see how much is being spent, first of all, on their premiums, and then second of all, on the actual care itself once they get to the doctor.
This, I mean, in the early stages of the Obamacare discussions, there was the talk of, you know, what we want to do is separate health insurance, which is also different than health, but medical insurance from the workplace, because it's, you know, it creates all kinds of weirdnesses, some of which you're talking about. Reason, for instance, I think our basic coverage is that the Reason picks up 75% of the premium for the employee. And you're paying 25% of a plan that then is paying a bunch of other stuff. It's almost impossible to get price signals in that, which is the main way that you kind of guide economic decision making and discovery processes. So this isn't going to affect that. How is it going to do anything?
The Republican bill does nothing to touch to deal with the employer sponsored insurance carve out. And Obamacare, for all of its faults, actually had a provision that tried, however weakly and imperfectly, to start dealing with that. It was called the Cadillac tax, which of course got delayed a whole bunch of years, and it was unclear if it was ever even going to go into effect. But in Obamacare, perhaps the best provision in Obamacare, the one that sort of free market types might be most amenable to, was the Cadillac tax.
Yeah.
And you don't see any attempt at all to deal with the ESI carve out in the Republican plan.
I want to make sure that I'm understanding it correctly, that part of the problem then is that when your employer gives you health benefits, it is not taxed. You don't receive it as compensation, that it's taxed as income. So that's one of the reasons why for many years and at various points because of wage and price controls, et cetera, it was health insurance or a medical plan could be a benefit, a fringe benefit, that your employer could give you more compensation without it necessarily being taxed or forbidden by a wage and price control.
So imagine it this way. If your employer gives you $1 pay raise, you're only taking, let's say, you only get about 70% of that, or 65 or 75, whatever. You get a portion of that after taxes, right?
Mm-hmm.
You don't get a full dollar. you get 70 cents because the government takes some out of that. If the government gives you $1 increase in health insurance benefits, you get the full dollar increase because it's not taxed. And as a result of this, over decades, over time, as the system got built up, employers, of course, started giving people more and more benefits and sort of building in these incredibly generous plans that sort of covered everything in a lot of cases and really insulated people from costs. At the same time, it left a fragmented system in which people who were not able to get coverage through their employer, people who were, say, self-employed, who were freelancers, folks like that, who bought on the individual market, they were at a huge disadvantage because, first, they were having to buy coverage using their taxed dollars, right? So they didn't get the advantage of the tax carve-out. And second of all, the market was pretty small and so badly served, which meant that, like, these people were just sort of second-class citizens in the healthcare system. That's what Obamacare tried to fix, but it tried to fix it by just sort of adding a new layer of subsidies and regulations on top of all the old layers of subsidies and regulations, and you ended up with a system that was arguably, if anything, you know, even more fragmented than the one that was before.
Does the Republican bill do anything about the Medicaid expansion?
The Republican bill does transform Medicaid into a sort of per capita block grant system starting in 2020. Now, there are sort of competing views on sort of the merits of of that transformation. There are folks like Obik Roy who say that this is, you know, one of the biggest biggest transformations, overhauls of an entitlement system ever in American history. There are other folks who sort of look at this and say it still gives states to ramp up coverage in the meantime because states can continue to expand before then. But the bigger question to me is, would that transformation ever actually happen? They delayed it to 2020 for a reason, which is that this is a sort of, I mean, that is a political hot potato if there ever was, you know, if you can imagine one. And a lot of Republicans in Congress come from states that expanded Medicaid under Obamacare. They often don't like to admit it. You know, Mike Pence expanded Medicaid in Indiana and then said that it was a rejection of Obamacare, hilariously.
That was because he kind of got a special program through, right? Or where he could pick up a fuss.
But everybody gets a waiver.
I'm not defending him. I'm saying
waivers. And it was, you know, they added in a sprinkling of you know, market-based mechanisms to what was basically what was fundamentally an Obamacare Medicaid expansion.
So here, though,
there's really no other way to characterize it.
To go to Obik Roy's point, though, that is actually – it's a good thing. I mean, and it's not – you know, maybe we shouldn't stand up and cheer, but it would be a good thing, wouldn't it, if the government said – you know, look, here, we're going to say, here's the amount of money that you get for healthcare this year. Deal with it. That would at least it would change things from an open-ended entitlement system to at least a closed entitlement system, right?
So the closed end still has increases attached to it, and in addition, it's not block granted per state; it's block granted per individual. And that's different than a lot of the block granting systems that we've seen proposed, sort of by free market types over the years. And so, I mean, look, I think that it is the sort of thing that is it's worth taking a look at. Like I said, even if this bill eventually passes in the Senate and becomes law, I'm not really sure it'll ever happen just because it's, you know, because the delay is in there, like I said, for a reason. And moderate Republicans already seem pretty uncomfortable.
So do you think it will pass the Senate? Is there a timeline yet for when it's going to show up in the Senate?
There's no timeline, and the Senate has already made clear that they will not take up this bill in its current form. In fact, they may not even start with this bill as sort of a framework. They are quite likely to simply write a brand new bill from scratch. And maybe a new bill will pass in the Senate, but then you have the problem of those bills have to be reconciled. The House and Senate can't pass totally different bills and then send them to the president, right?
Right.
And so the changes that are likely to create a bill that could plausibly pass in the Senate, and again, I think it's going to be tough. Just any bill is going to have a tough road in the Senate, no matter what. But the type of bill that could maybe pass is not really going to be palatable to the House Freedom Caucus, which was sort of the conservative group that was the locus of a bunch of the opposition in the House.
So, you know, you wrote a great piece at Reason within the past couple of weeks about how the Republican the problem with the Republican Party is not that they don't have a replacement bill, but that they don't have a unified theory of, you know, of market-based, market-driven, market-efficient, innovative healthcare, you know, that increases the quality of care while making the price cheaper and, you know, creating more innovation. What do we do? Like, if you had your druthers, you know, what is the libertarian approach to fixing healthcare or health insurance? Because we're not going to get there with this legislation, even assuming it passes, because then it'll be delayed and it'll be kicked around until it's basically the Republicans can say, oh, we repealed and replaced Obamacare, and here, you know. But so, you know, lay out what do we do to get to that promised land of a better, freer, cheaper, more innovative health market.
So I'll talk about a couple of principles here that because I think that's the best way to sort of start these conversations. And I think it's honestly what a lot of Republicans lack when they talk about healthcare, kind of basic principles. One thing to think about here is, of course, that what is insurance good at? Health insurance is still insurance. It's a financial product, right? It's not a doctor. It's not healthcare itself.
Right.
And what we know that health insurance is quite good at is protecting people from the financial shocks that are related to unexpected high-cost healthcare events. And so health insurance would focus on being good insurance rather than being on comprehensive care. And we would think about it that way and design policies that are designed to maximize that. In addition, we would I think that government probably does have some role in subsidizing care for the truly needy. I don't think that, you know, the libertarian position is absolutely zero intervention at all, no government dollars ever spent on anybody's health care. But we would focus on creating policies that targeted the actually needy.
Right.
And right now, a huge amount of healthcare spending goes to Medicare, which of course is a program for seniors regardless of their income.
Right.
And Medicaid is quite dysfunctional in a lot of places, and in a lot of ways. And so what we've done is actually spend a lot of money on a relatively wealthy cohort, while creating a pretty dysfunctional system for folks who for the needy and the disabled.
Right. Yeah.
And then in addition, the other thing that we should be doing is we should be saying that routine care, as much as possible for people who can afford it, should work like a market, and should be, you know, sort of subject, and that people should be paying for themselves. There should be prices, we should look for kind of price clarity and competition. And so we would probably end up in my totally pie in the sky, politics doesn't matter world, with a system perhaps of some sort of system of catastrophic health insurance for maybe most people, perhaps mm-hmm. not everyone, but for a lot of people, and for a robust program, of subsidies targeted at the actually poor and needy.
Yep.
And then the folks in the middle and the costs in the middle of that, right? All the sort of daily expected costs that middle class and upper middle class people sort of can know that they are going to encounter throughout their lives would be paid for through market-based systems, whether they are purchasing some sort of prepayment plan, mm-hmm. because people don't always like to pay priced healthcare at the point of care, or whether they're paying out of pocket to doctors, you know, sort of on a per service basis, whatever that is, we would see different mechanisms pop up. But of course, and then the other part of this is that all of this would be sort of equalized so that there's not this, you know, hugely fragmented differentiation between those people who get healthcare through their employer and
right.
those folks who don't.
Well,
right?
It's just
you want to wipe that out somehow or another.
Yeah, that may.
And of course, you want this to be sort of done with as few regulations as possible, and with, you know, without taxes that are likely to sort of destroy, you know, to minimize innovation and to sort of stop people from doing things. You would want to, you know, sort of as smooth a tax system as you could imagine to fund all of this.
That's the most politically impossible plan you can imagine. But
right?
Why is that? I mean, stop for a second, because I was going to say, you know, that sounds like let's get started on that tomorrow. So, you know, what is the, you know, obviously politically, you know, maybe there are as many original sins, you know, in U.S. policy as there are policies, but, you know, it might have been tying medical insurance to employers and the tax carve-outs and stuff like that. But what is the biggest holdup? Because clearly nobody is happy. You know, everybody's happy with their doctor, but everybody's kind of pissed at the insurance market system. And, you know, is it old people who are like, don't take, you know, get the government out of my Medicare? Is it doctors who want to just keep money coming their way, even if they're having more and more trouble, kind of, you know, more and more of them are working for insurance companies? Is it the insurance companies? Is it out of touch politicians? I mean, like, what is the logjam here? Because we all know that the system is not working.
The logjam is everything.
Yeah. All right. Well, I guess that's why it's a logjam.
There's no shorter way to – the logjam is people hate disruption. And this was a big problem for Obamacare, which canceled somewhere in the range of 5 million plans after saying that if you like your health care plan, you can keep it.
And that was
a huge, huge political problem, as well as sort of, it created ripple effects of policy problems.
Yeah, it's amazing to think about how much, you know, it's not that long ago, but we kind of forget it already how much Obama had to go to get his own party on board. And like the sweeteners, yep. and a number of politicians who basically exited American politics after being sweetened enough where they voted for Obamacare. But it was, yeah.
And you saw that again with the Republican bill, where there were all of these kind of legislative kickbacks handed out in the last couple of weeks in order to get the holdouts on board. And this was for the Obamacare repeal. I'll put that in quotes.
Yeah.
The Obamacare repeal bill, the biggest and most frequently made promise by Republican politicians of the last 7 years, it was like an incredibly tough lift to get this across, to get this out of the House. And in the end, it passed by exactly one vote.
And you, I guess we'll end on this. The idea of a kind of systemic reform is probably a pipe dream. But what are the conditions then that would allow that space, or how do we build a consensus so that, you know, if we, you know, I can't even think of the right metaphor of rearranging deck chairs on the Titanic doesn't quite get there. But it's like, you know, we're like, we're kind of like in an infinite loop of where we're knitting and unknitting the same, you know, Afghan or something like that. And it's just like, we're not getting anywhere with this. What has to happen for a space for actual policy change?
I think that it's hard and there's no good solution. If there was one, we would have seen better policies been put in place over the last couple of decades. But I think the key is probably to move slowly and incrementally, and to understand that as frustrating as those slow and incremental changes are going to be to people who like them and to people who don't, that is the only way that you're going to move this system. Because like I said, the biggest thing about American health policy politically is that people hate disruption, and that's people who work in healthcare, which is a fifth or a sixth, you know, nearly 20% of the economy at this point. Nobody wants their dollars disrupted. Healthcare is still a source of good middle-class jobs for a lot of people, as well as a lot of really well-paid people. And people, even though people don't love insurance companies, they tend to like their own doctors and their own insurance plans. And so you can't politically, regardless of whether we should from a policy perspective, you just can't do very much that is highly disruptive in a short period of time. And, that is one of the problems with Obamacare, is that it was designed to be as minimally disruptive as possible, but people didn't like it throughout Obama's presidency, in part because of the disruptions that it caused. And that is a big problem for Republicans as they are now trying to pass the American Health Care Act.
So we have people choosing dysfunction over disruption. And that's a hard nut to crack.
And it only gets worse over time.
Yeah. All right. Well, we will leave it there. We have been talking with Peter Suderman. He's the features editor at Reason, Reason Magazine, Reason.com. Peter, thanks so much for talking to us about this ugly delivery of a healthcare reform bill by the Republican House.
Thanks for having me, Nick.
This has been the Reason Podcast. I'm Nick Gillespie. Thank you for listening, and please subscribe to us at iTunes and rate and review us while you're there.